gravitational waves. So usually the study of gravitational waves in general relativity is broken down into two different steps. One is the sources and one is the propagation. So for example, if we have two black holes, they're orbiting each other, they're emitting gravitational waves. The process that generates gravitational waves, in some sense, you can think of it as being a little bit different from just the nature of gravitational waves propagating in vacuum. So what we're first going to do is we're going to look at the linearized field equations to see what the nature of gravitational waves in vacuum are. So they've been produced by some source, we don't care how. We're just going to want to say, what are the propagating degrees of freedom of space-time as given by general relativity? And then we'll look a little bit at the source problem, and if we have time, we'll derive the quadrupole formula. So both of these things we're going to get from the linearized field equations, but in some sense, they're sort of distinct questions. One is asking what the propagating degrees of freedom are. We don't really care where those solutions came from. And on the other hand, we're now thinking about, how can we produce these disturbances in space-time? So we're going to do this in the context of linearized gravity. And there are many ways of going about this, but the easiest way, in particular since we've covered the harmonic form last time, is to just look at the linearized field equations in harmonic gauge. Okay. Okay, so looking at linearized gravity, so we're going to start from the Einstein field equations in the harmonic form. And in particular, we're going to choose the harmonic gauge. We're going to get set H equal to 0. So just to remind you, in terms of the metric, this is the form of the field equations. Okay, so this is the full field equation in harmonic gauge, but now we want to look at perturbations about some background. So we're going to look at small perturbations about Minkowski space-time. So in particular, we're going to assume that we're in a coordinate system which is also well adapted to this. So in our coordinate system, we can assume that the metric is the Minkowski metric plus some other piece of perturbation. And the magnitude of this perturbation is much less than the characteristic size of whatever coordinate system we want to represent Minkowski space-time in. I mean, for simplicity, we could just think of Cartesian coordinates, right? So this is just, minus dt squared. But it doesn't really matter. But in any case, whatever the representation of our metric is, the perturbation is much smaller in terms of the coordinates. So again, assuming that the metric as this form already says something about the coordinate system, because of course we can always choose some coordinates where, Minkowski, the coefficients are very large, they're not of order one. And you can also choose coordinates where the perturbations look large, but they're not necessarily. So we're going to choose coordinates where this condition holds. Then we're going to substitute this into the field equations, and we're only going to keep terms to linear order in the perturbation. So sub into and only keep So let's just think of Cartesian coordinates, because this is the simplest form. So the metric is just a constant diagonal unit matrix here. So these terms, these are gradients of the metric squared. So if we take a derivative, this term vanishes. So it's going to be gradients of this, but it's going to be squared. So this is second order. So this term drops out. Similarly with the connections, these are gradients of the metric, and we're squaring them. So this is also nonlinear, second order. So the only term that survives is this one. And if you think, well, what is the inverse metric? Again, it's going to be sort of the inverse Minkowski metric plus a small perturbation. And that perturbation is then going to be multiplied by second derivatives of the matrix, or second derivatives of this. And so the piece of the metric that's, this part in this inverse is also going to be second order. So what it boils down to is this is the only term that survives on the left-hand side. And effectively, you can raise and lower with a Minkowski metric. So the Minkowski metric differs from the full metric by this term, but in any way in which raising and lowering appears in the field equations, that's only going to be a second order correction. So, oops. So if we do that, let's just multiply everything by negative a half, we get the following. Yes, well, we'll just keep it. This doesn't really matter. We're going to fix this. Plus terms that are of order h squared. Now, the way that the linearized, I mean, this is essentially the linearized equation. So we're going to call this is essentially the box operator. And again, if you're putting the full box operator, the full wave operator, in terms of the full metric to leading order, it's just going to be the wave operator with respect to the Minkowski metric again. So this is just with respect to first order. But the way that the linearized equations are usually presented is in terms of the trace reversed metric perturbation. So we're going to define an H bar H is the trace. And so in some sense, what we're doing here is we got to the generalized harmonic form by sort of reversing the trace. Now we're just going to reverse it back in some sense. And so if you do this, what you'll find is and now just for completeness, I'm going to put in the units again. So this is the linearized field equations in harmonic gauge for the trace reversed perturbations. So it's important to remember here that we are in harmonic gauge, so we've imposed the harmonic gauge condition. So quite a simple system of equations. If we don't have any stress energy, so it's vacuum and this side is zero, then this is just the wave equation, sort of a scalar wave equation for each metric component. The thing that makes it slightly less trivial than that is that we have this, we've imposed this gauge condition. And to leading order, what the harmonic gauge condition is that the perturbation is divergence-free. Okay, so we can any metric perturbation satisfying the wave equation that's divergence-free is a solution to the linearized field equations. But it's going to turn out, as we'll show, that not all of them can be interpreted as gravitational waves, because it turns out that we haven't used up all of our coordinate degrees of freedom by imposing harmonic gauge. There is still some residual gauge freedom. And so if you just throw down any solution, it will in general be a superposition of a real gravitational wave and just some gauge mode. So to really isolate what the gravitating degrees or the radiating degrees of freedom are, we want to completely fix the gauge. So let's do that. Okay. So there is still residual gauge freedom. In particular, if we imagine changing coordinates, let's choose a prime coordinate as follows. So these are our original coordinates. Let's transform coordinates in this fashion. And what we'll have to impose is that that the magnitude of the gradients are no bigger order of magnitude than the gradient of the perturbation, so that we, consistent with our initial condition, that this is going to be a small perturbation. But so we're allowed to change the coordinates by some small infinitesimal perturbation or some small perturbation. But we still, this new coordinate, for this these equations to be valid, these new coordinates also have to be harmonic. So if we take the box of this expression, this has to be zero. So box of x is zero by construction. These are harmonic coordinates. So if box x prime has to be zero, that implies that these functions have to also be harmonic. So what this is saying is we still have the residual freedom we have left is we can change the coordinates by adding some harmonic functions to them. So functions that satisfy box x equals zero, we can add them to the coordinates, and we'll still have harmonic coordinates. Okay, so you can figure out exactly how the metric transforms under such a coordinate transformation. I'm not going to write that down. Because in the end, what we do with these kinds of coordinate transformations, at least in this situation, we never actually construct them explicitly. We're just sort of using them to argue that we have degrees of freedom to simplify things and assume that that we can actually do so. So it doesn't really matter what the coordinate transformation are. But essentially what this is saying is we have four coordinates, we have four functions that we can choose, so we have four conditions that we can apply to simplify the metric. Now, I mean, one question you might ask, is it always going to be possible to come up with such functions? Well, we haven't even specified the solution to begin with, but in some generic situation, say we're looking at a strong field source, we don't have necessarily this extra residual freedom. We solve the space-time and harmonic gauge, we look at the waves, can we actually make a transformation where we're going to get, at the end, the simple result that there are only two polarizations, the plus and the cross. And in vacuum, you can prove that you can always do what we're going to be doing now. So in vacuum, you can show that the following is what's, I'll explain in the next few words, but the following, which is essentially the transverse traceless gauge conditions. Transverse or just TT always the following conditions can always be chosen or imposed. And if you want to see that there's a good article, a review article in the archive by Flanagan and Hughes on gravitational waves. See Flanagan and Hughes. It's a few years ago. If you search on the archive for them, you'll find it. In an appendix, they actually go through the proof of why this is always possible. So we have 4 degrees of freedom, and at least when in regions of the vacuum space-time, we can always impose them in a particular way to come up with this transverse traceless gauge. So, okay, so we have 4 conditions, and so with a transverse traceless gauge, the conditions that we're going to impose is one, that this metric perturbation is traceless. And so from now onwards, you know, if we impose this condition, H bar is H. I'm just going to drop the bars. There's no distinction between the trace reversed and the trace form of the metric. So this is one condition. And now I'm going to introduce sort of the letters I, J, etc. to be the spatial indices. Right, so I, for instance, and the index 0 is going to be the time. Yeah.
You should decompose H alpha beta in scalar vector and symmetric metrics.
Yeah.
Traceless, then you should H bar, I mean, the trace should be 0. And
sorry, the trace should
the
be.
The trace of H, that is the scalar part, should be always 0.
Should always be.
Yeah, 0. I mean, if you decompose the gravity perturbation scalar vector and.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so right. So the gravitational wave part of the metric is always going to be traceless. I mean, in regions where they matter, you can find, I mean, you don't have to have a metric where the perturbation, I mean, if you think of it as a perturbation, is traceless. But I guess it's the combination of traceless, the transverse traceless conditions as a whole that can always be imposed in vacuum. So that this might be a much more general condition that you could probably impose in general, but it's this together with the following condition now. And this still doesn't mean that you can't, in certain matter regions, impose these conditions, but you can at least prove that you can always do this in vacuum. So this is the one condition, and the other one is that the space-time component of the metric is 0. So these are the transverse traceless conditions. And again, because now I just runs over 3 indices. This is 3 conditions, this is 1. So you know, we have 4 degrees of freedom, and these are the 4 conditions. Okay, so well, we also have more than 4 conditions. Remember, we also still have the harmonic condition. So that this is also still satisfied. Okay, so if we combine this one, if we combine 2 with the harmonic condition, for the time component, so let's just take beta equals 0, and that will say that time derivative of H00 plus the spatial gradients are 0. But from this condition, these are 0. And this says, therefore, that, so this is the time derivative. So H00 is a constant. So if you imagine a situation where, let's say we have exactly Minkowski spacetime at some point, then a gravitational wave passes. Because H00 is a constant for all time, we can choose this to be 0. Okay. So to summarize then, so in harmonic transfers traceless gauge, sort of a gravitational wave perturbation satisfies So yeah, I'm explicitly just focusing on the spatial component. So this is now a 3x3 matrix. The time components are all zero by our gauge conditions. Right, so let me just write it explicitly. So this is zero. We still have our harmonic condition that has to be satisfied. And it's traceless. Right, so these are the different conditions. So any solution that satisfies the wave equation subject to these conditions is a gravitational wave. And it's without, I mean, sort of proved it here, but this is sort of, we've used up all of our coordinate degrees of freedom here. So this is the true, the true propagating degrees of freedom. Okay, so just to sort of explicitly show where we get the plus and the cross polarizations out of this, let's solve this equation. In Minkowski space-time, we know exactly what these solutions are. I mean, we knew them back there. But now let's just take the solutions and apply these conditions to see what we get. So the solution to the wave equation is just a superposition of wave packets propagating in some direction. And because this is linear, we can superimpose those. And so without loss of generality, we can just pick a direction. And so let's solve. Without loss of generality, let's look at the wave propagating in the plus c direction. So then the solution is just that the metric perturbation as a function of space and time is a set of constant coefficients. Constant. Times some arbitrary functions, our wave packet that depends on t minus z. So of course a general solution will be a sum of waves propagating in the minus z direction, in the x direction, in the y direction with arbitrary functions. So this is just some arbitrary function. Okay. But now we want to see what do these conditions over there imply about what this coefficient matrix can be. So this is subject to the gauge conditions. Okay, so first let's look at the harmonic condition. Okay. And let's look at the z component of this harmonic condition. So that just says so if we look at the form of the solution, it only depends on t and z. So these are just constant coefficients. So okay, so there's no time derivative here. The x and y derivatives vanish. So the only condition, the only component that's relevant is the zz component. And so the derivative of that with respect to z is just minus the derivative of this function f, whatever it is, but it's an arbitrary function. And so this implies that f prime times ajz equals zero. Now, because this is an arbitrary function, that implies that all these coefficients are zero. In other words, quite explicitly, we have our matrix of coefficients. Now we have that the z components are all zero. So we only have and the final step is to notice that this the traceless condition, of course I haven't mentioned this, but the metric is symmetric because our original metric was symmetric. So essentially we have a non-zero 2x2 matrix. So we have a non-zero 2x2 matrix that's trace-free and symmetric. So let me just write this as a capital indices. So the ij indices are just going to run over x and y. And so any 2x2 symmetric trace-free matrix, you can uniquely decompose it into these basis matrices. And so this constant coefficient we're going to call H plus, and this one H cross. So we have two solutions, two polarizations. And by this decomposition, this is where the plus and the cross polarizations come from. So then that's the answer. Okay. So putting this all together, the metric perturbation and transverse traceless gauge. Well, this wave is just and then of course the general solution is now going to be a superposition of waves propagating in arbitrary directions. Any questions, comments? Okay, so this quite a simple exercise, going from the linearized equations to this solution. The only tricky thing is, one, keeping in mind that we have these gauge conditions that restrict the class of solutions, and just to, again, I haven't shown that this really is the only degrees of freedom in the Einstein equations, but it turns out that this really is the true gravitating degrees of freedom. In particular, if you were to compute the curvature that's produced by this perturbation, it would be non-zero. So you can add, like, a gauge mode is not going to produce any curvature. It's just a coordinate mode. But this really does have curvature, and it does carry energy. Time here. So let me just sort of to figure out the energy in a gravitational wave. That's a really messy business. In some sense, you have to go to second order in perturbation theory, because now we want to say, okay, now let's take this solution, plug it into the Einstein equations. This is going to produce curvature, but let's move this now to the right-hand side and call that the stress energy of the space-time. And then you also have to do various averaging things, but I'll just quote. So these waves produce curvature. So move them to the right-hand side at second order. You can define the effective stress energy of the gravitational waves. And the energy density, so this is sort of so when you do this, you usually get a pseudo-tensor. So this is not an invariant object, but this is one way to do it. So it's with respect to a given background. But the zero component of this effective stress energy tensor is essentially just equal to the time derivative of the plus and the cross polarization amplitude squared. And there's also really sort of an averaging, so we really want to do a decomposition, a Fourier decomposition sort of average, but this is the answer. And the reason why I showed it is that sort of this makes sense. This is a positive definite quantity, the sum of the amplitude squares. So it's very much like what you'd expect for a classical field theory, something like E and M, or a scalar field theory. Okay. So we have about, I think I can quickly go through the sources of gravitational waves, just to show you where the quadrupole formula comes from. So we're going to do essentially the same thing that we did solving the linearized equations, but now we're going to have a right-hand side, we're going to have matter, and we're going to do it in somewhat in reversed order. We're actually going to explicitly solve the equations without imposing the gauge, and then we'll do just a little trick in the end to impose transverse traceless gauge. Okay, so we're going to solve the linearized equations for the trace reversed perturbation. And we're just going to solve it using Green's functions method. So this is, again, in Minkowski space. So this is just a flat space wave equation with the source. So the solution is just the integral of the source multiplied by the Green's function, right? So to solve by Green's functions method, solve using Green's functions. Right, so we're going to treat each one of these as a scalar wave operator, sort of a scalar wave function, right? So recall if we have this is our equation, so the scalar wave equation operating on a function f driven by some source. The formal solution is given by the integral of the source convolved with the Green's function. Or in this in the following. Where in Minkowski space, so the Green's function is the solution to this wave equation with a delta function source. In Minkowski space time, the Green's function is just time. Given by the following. But essentially just a delta function propagating away from the origin at the speed of light, decaying with 1 over the distance from the source. Okay. Okay, and yeah, in the notation that I've used here, this magnitude operator, this is just the following. Okay, so let's plug this into the Einstein equations, and so we get that the solution for the metric perturbation. And we're just going to look at the spatial perturbations now, because we're eventually going to restrict to transverse traceless. So now we're just looking at the spatial components, and it's going to be the same as if we did all the transverse traceless stuff to begin with, solve the equations. We're just going to do that at the end. Integrating over xk prime here. So the stress tensor is a function of space and time. This is the argument to the time, and this is the space divided by the distance. So and this is, in some sense, the answer, but to get to the quadrifold formula, we're going to make a couple of approximations, assumptions to simplify this expression here. So to simplify, there are a couple of things that we're going to do. First, we're going to assume, so here we have the source. So here we have our stress energy. This thing is moving, it's doing what it's doing, it's radiating gravitational waves. We're going to assume that the source has compact support, that it's only non-zero in some region of size L in the space-time. So it's got some characteristic size L. And we're going to be sitting here, we're going to be observing the source at a distance R that's much greater than L. So we're observing it here at a distance R much greater than L. And the second simplification is that the velocities in the source are going to be small relative to the speed of light. And I'll show exactly where that comes from. But this first approximation, that we're very far from the source, we're going to use it to simplify these two terms in the expression. So with this approximation, so we can write this We can expand. Okay, let me just write it explicitly. So let me just do this a little bit bigger. Okay, so here's our origin. Here's our source. Here's a point xk prime in the source that we're going to be, so we're going to be integrating over all of xk prime. And here, this is where we're going to be evaluating the stress tensor, sorry, the gravitational wave perturbation at xk. So this is, this is the, this is the distance that we want to evaluate in the quadrupole formula. Let's define a unit vector n hat to be a vector that's pointing from the origin to the source. So n hat I is just xi divided by r. So with this little geometry of the picture, we can expand this as follows. So this is just r minus, and this is sort of a standard simplification assumption that's done in ENM as well when you want to look at in the wave zone far from a source. Okay. So this is a unit vector. Because we're going to be integrating within, when we integrate, it's just going to be within this regime of characteristic size L. This term is going to be of size L. Right? So this is of order unity. This is at most of order 1. So this is of order L. And then this thing is essentially going to be of order R over L. Sorry, L over R. So in the denominator, if we sort of do this expansion to leading order, we can just essentially replace the denominator with R. And so let me go and do it here. Okay. Okay, so with this assumption, replace denominator with 1 over r. And r is a constant. We can factor it out of the integral then. Now, let's look at this term, and let's do a Taylor expansion. So this is the time argument of the source function. So let's substitute this into this term and Taylor expand. So for the numerator, we get to dot just the time derivative. So again, this term in the expansion is of order L. So this term, this is the time derivative of the source. So this is of order 1 over tau, where tau is some characteristic time scale in the source. So if we assume that L over tau is much less than 1, which is essentially assuming that the velocities are relatively small. And we can drop this term. So is assuming that the velocities in the source are much less than the speed of light, then we can drop this. And so with those two assumptions, we get the following. So the metric perturbation observed at that distance from the source is roughly, decays like 1 over distance from the source, and we have this integral over the spatial components of the stress tensor, essentially evaluated at the retarded time t minus r, and we integrate over the spatial components. Okay, so we're almost there. How much time do we have left? 5 minutes. So there are a couple of tricks now that we can do to simplify this expression. So right now, we're looking at metric perturbations in terms of integrating over the pressures in the source. I mean, this is a valid expression, but it's much more useful to think of it in terms of the energy density in the source, and the quadrupole formulas in terms of time derivatives of the energy density. So there are a couple of sort of tricks that we can do to get to change the form of this expression. It's essentially using conservation of energy. So now we're going to further simplify. Using conservation of stress energy. In other words, that stress energy tensor is divergence free. These are sort of clever little tricks, so I just want to show them explicitly. Okay, so we're going to start with, let's write down the time, a couple of components of the conservation of stress energy. So let's just look at the time-time component. And let's just call the time-time component the energy density of the source. And then now let's look at a space, one of the spatial components. Okay. So we differentiate this one with respect to time, this one with respect to space, and we're going to combine them. So if we do so, so we're going to get a second derivative of the energy density, we'll be able to eliminate one of the terms, and what we'll get is the second time derivative of the energy density is equal to this double gradient of the spatial of the pressures. So that's the first trick, using stress-energy tensor to now sort of relate essentially gradients of the spatial pressures with time derivatives of the energy density. Now we're going to multiply this by just the coordinates. So we're going to multiply both sides by xi, xj. So we're going to have xi, xj times this, xi, xj times this. And then we're going to commute gradients with this term, to multiply by xi, xj, and commute with the gradients. So if you do this, so this is not just an identity, just apply the chain rule. You get, so the second time derivative of rho times xi, xj place. Plus two. So this is just an identity going from this to this by using this little trick. But now we can see we can solve for Tij in terms of the second time derivative of this quantity plus these two quantities, but these are total divergences. So if we then take, so the idea here is to solve for Tij and plug it into that expression up there. So put a little star over there. So we're going to plug it into that expression. And then these terms are going to become boundary integrals by the divergence theorem. But because we're evaluating this in a vacuum part of space-time, the space energy tends to be zero. So they're going to drop out. So spatial gradients, spatial divergences, boundary terms, and we set them equal to zero. And so with this trick we get essentially almost the final form of the quadrupole formula, which is the following. A few minutes longer, but just a couple more minutes and then I'll be done. So if we do that, so this is just an integral over x prime. And this quantity, this is just, we'll evaluate it every retarded time, but this is just the quadrupole moment of the energy density. Right, so let's just define this. This just defines the quadrupole moment tensor. And in doing the substitution, I've also commuted the integration with the second time derivative. So we've taken the second time derivative out. So this is just the quadrupole moment tensor of the source. So this is just 2 over r times the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment tensor evaluated at a time t minus r. And so the final thing is we want to write not what the trace reverse perturbations are, but the actual metric perturbations. So if we reverse the trace again, so this is the way that you'll usually see it written in textbooks. And you change this I to a squiggly I, and so this is just a trace reversed quadrupole moment where this object is just defined to be the usual quadrupole moment minus its trace. So actually it's trace reversed, not trace reduced. Sorry, trace removed, the trace free quadrupole moment tensor. So this is the answer. And then to restrict to transverse traceless gauge, essentially you just project this onto the space that's orthogonal to the direction of propagation. Let me just write that out explicitly. And that'll be the last thing done. Right, so here we have the source. We're assuming that we're very far from it. We've got this metric perturbation here at the source. It's the second time derivative of this trace-free quadruple moment tensor integrated over the source. But now if you want to restrict your transverse trace this gauge, so we know we have the waves are propagating in this direction n hat. And we know that in transverse trace this gauge, there's no disturbance transverse to the direction of propagation. Sorry, there's no disturbance orthogonal direction. It's all transverse, right? And so effectively, if you went through the algebra, what that really means is you just take this expression and you project it onto the surface that's orthogonal to the direction of propagation, making sure that you also eliminate the trace-free part of the perturbation. So the answer in transverse traceless gauge is just this expression multiplied by an appropriate projection tensor, which is the following. So now in TT gauge. KL. Second time derivative. And this is the projection operator. Where Pij is defined to be delta ij minus n I n j. So this is just a usual projection operator if you want to project it onto a space orthogonal to these vectors. And then this just subtracts out the trace. And that is effectively, this does the transverse traceless gauge for us. So this is a quadruple formula. Any questions? Sorry, I rushed a little bit here because if I had stopped, there would be like 2-3 minutes hanging. So, but I guess there are two things that I wanted to point out. It's just the linearized equations, but with a couple of assumptions that we're far from the source is moving slow, and then a couple of clever little tricks to write it in terms of just the time derivative of the energy density of the source. Okay, thanks. So tomorrow Luis is going to talk about constraint damping, and on Friday I'll talk about adaptive mesh refinements.